on a dark desert highway, staying just out of sight. Just like White House crashers, I don't have an invite. Up ahead in the distance, across the cactus and sage, I know I can find a brand new job, and I'll make minimum wage. Walking inside the border, a million stars out tonight. And I was thinking to myself, this place is heaven if you were just white. Then I see a big searchlight, it was heading my way. I was spotted by a border guard, and then I heard him say,
welcome to the state of Arizona. Have your papers, please, or you'll have to leave. There isn't much room in the state of Arizona if you're darker than George Hamilton.
So would you stop Obama? Say his race isn't pure.
Last week I stopped someone named Sonia Sotomayor.
Let me check my pocket. I belong here, of course. I will show you my proof now, if you will show me yours. Welcome to my homeland. I was born here. Yes, we've been here.
That's kind of clear.
5,000 years. I'm Navajo. We own this land you're on now. We fought illegals too since 1492.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Big Brother is Watching. Heidi Bogosian talks about government surveillance, corporate power, and public resistance with Robert Scheer.
I think we need to be having several battles on a number of different fronts. I love the idea of opting in. I also don't.
Does everybody understand what we mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
I also don't think that it's ever too late. I have a favorite passage I want to read briefly. A quotation from Committee Chair Frank Church of the Church Committee that was formed after revelations of COINTELPRO were brought forward by citizens who broke into the FBI local office in Media, Pennsylvania. And at that time, outrage publicly was so enormous that the programs were quickly stopped. Although J. Edgar Hoover did say that he considered them a success and there was great possibility they could be reopened in the future. But Church, who was a Democrat from Idaho, said that every presidential administration in the past, be it Republican or Democrat, had abused their power. And he said, quote, the NSA's capability at any time could be turned around on the American people and no American would have any privacy left. If any dictator ever took over, the NSA would enable it to impose total tyranny. And there would be no way to fight back. And I don't think it's true there's no way to fight back. We have choices we can make as consumers. And quite honestly, consumerism has brought us to a large degree to where we are right now. But I think that we've seen such failures of government officials who have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution to really do their job, that it's worth reminding us that as we the people, we are an important part of holding the government in check and making them do their job. So I think opt-out is one possibility.
opt in.
And what you said about the businesses who say they have no choice, well, they do have a choice. And I know they're pressured so much by government to have what they call a back door where law enforcement can gain access to our information even more easily than they do now. But I think if we go back to the days of the Church Committee, what they did was put in protections, the Attorney General guidelines, as they're called, and Attorney General Levi said that the FBI can't spy on political dissidents and, you know, politically active individuals based on their religious or other ideologies. They have to have probable cause that some criminal activity is underway. And over the decades that have passed since then, those protections have been eroded, both federal protections and the ones that state, local municipalities have in place. Now, after the USA Patriot Act, we've seen consent decrees that have been put in place in police departments across the country fizzle away. And now an agent only really has to say that they, in good faith, believe that an investigation should be opened. An example that we just found out a couple of weeks ago, purely by accident, by activists in Washington State, where there's an important lawsuit going on involving the Army spying on peace groups, but actually destroying the peace groups. The local police worked with a fusion center, followed these activists, gave them, you know, really multiple arrests for non-existent charges. One person was kicked out of his apartment. Others suffered emotional damage, and the peace groups were destroyed. But one of the activists filed Freedom of Information Act requests and found out about Project Hemisphere, which the New York Times reported on 3 or 4 weeks ago, where this government is actually paying AT&T staff to sit side by side with drug enforcement agencies and to have access to AT&T phone records going back 26 years. And I'm saying this because I think that when we have data that is stored, as you said, and building a new data center in Utah, which can house more computers so that they can process more data, we're really seeing a race, an international race, for which government can accumulate the most data. And clearly the U.S. wants to be at that top of the list. Hand in hand with that goes an enormous amount of secrecy about these programs, so that it's often just by accident that we learn really the extent to which our personal records are being gathered, stored, and then with storage really at risk of not only inaccurate data, but getting in the hands of people who may want to alter your medical or financial or other records. So there's a lot of possibility for manipulation. I've sort of lost track of the beginning of the question.
Well, the beginning of the question was the division between the private and government. And one could argue that the private sector has a stake in protecting privacy, or you'll switch to another carrier or so forth. It seems to me the government, particularly after 9/11, comes in and says, bullshit, you know, I'm sorry, I forgot his C-SPAN, bull, you know, but that you're going to turn it over to us. And there have been some noises of resistance, but in the main, they have turned it over. I think there were a few examples of people resisting or companies resisting, but I think the general feeling is they turn over everything.
And I think so they're afraid if they don't turn it over.
Well, and then I think now with the Apple 5S, you know, I have the 5. I thought today maybe I'll go get the 5S. But this is an incredible thing. The American people might, you know, if you had asked people, hey, you got to turn over your fingerprint, or, you know, but we may have a situation where most Americans voluntarily not only turn over their fingerprint, but connect that fingerprint, as I said before, with every book, every record, every dinner they have. I mean, it's incredible. If Stalin's Russia had been able to do that, you know, that would have been the mark of totalitarianism, right? Everyone in the Soviet Union had to have this fingerprint connected with every purchase they made, every meal. Well, that would be the ultimate totalitarian fantasy. And yet we are on the cusp now of doing it voluntarily. And I suspect people in this room routinely, your machine, you're right, says, can we use your location? Well, hell, you want to Yelp to see if that restaurant is around the corner? You give, I mean, maybe you don't, but most people do. Okay, use my location. I'm trying to find a movie in my area. I'm trying to find it. And you're turning over the most private thing, you know. And then as far as the, you know, I think you make a very good point, this question of whether it's misused. Well, it can be altered, and it can be distorted, and it can be selectively. I was thinking just the other day, I wanted to give a lecture on censorship. I am giving a lecture on censorship next week. So I'm downloading books that were formerly censored. You know, I'm sorry, I was using Amazon. I didn't have an independent bookstore near me. And I was downloading D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley's Lover, and Anais Nin, and Henry Miller. And suddenly I realized I'm now presenting a portrait in the eyes of some people of a pervert. You know, I think that is fine literature, by the way. I don't have that view. But, you know, you have to think twice. Everyone knows what books you're downloading. Let's say, so we have a very good essay in Truth Dig today by Chris Hedges on the roots of radical dissent. And so he's quoting Rosa Luxemburg, and he's, so I'm checking out Rosa, you know, doing my fact checking. And now I'm an anarchist. You know, revolutionary. And so you are creating profiles of yourself that can easily be used by others.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. and you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook. And now, back to Big Brothers Watching with Heidi Bogosian and Robert Scheer.
And the data aggregators, as marketers, have similar profiles. And one of the problems with selecting tidbits of data and not really looking at it as an integrated whole is that, just as you say, your choice of what movies you see, what products you buy, may label you as an anarchist. And the danger is, with the anarchist, right now, it again goes back to the issue of funding for private corporations. There's competition among, you know, Department of Homeland Security and other local agencies that receive DHS funding, say a municipal police department, to identify so-called terrorist threats. Now we see the catch-all anarchist being used a lot, years after the environmental and animal rights activists in 2005 were deemed top domestic terrorism threats. Now it's anarchists. I was at the Republican National Convention in Florida the year before last, and the police issued, or the FBI issued, a report of an anarchist threat because on top of a building there was some graffiti near, I guess, where some of the delegates were, and a brick. And so taken alone, and even though there were very few protesters there, they issued a report, the media carried it, and it continues to perpetuate negative stereotypes about individuals who are merely, in many cases, exercising their First Amendment rights, but are being deemed, because they question the status quo and corporate or government policies, they're now called anarchists. But the labeling is very real because, as you know, that can be used to stigmatize, alienate groups, and even in the case of animal rights activists, create federal legislation, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, that in many cases punishes what we traditionally called civil disobedience and other forms of protest, such as leafleting or chalking a sidewalk. They imbue those with evil connotations and higher fines and higher penalties.
So I just want to move on to, when I wrote my article for Yahoo Internet Life on privacy, so it was just a year before 9/11, And I had all these concerns. And then 9/11, as they say, changed everything. It was suddenly on steroids. And now the argument is that for national security to find terrorists, we have to invade all the private space. Our government has to invade all the private space. And, you know, it was George Washington in his farewell address who warned us about the impostures of pretended patriotism. It's, I believe, Ben Franklin who warned us about those who would sacrifice. I don't know if I read that in your book.
Right.
It is?
Right.
So what's the quote?
Those who would sacrifice freedom deserve none, or to that effect.
For security deserve
right.
neither. And it's, you know, I just did an article today on the, they discovered, there's a very good article, I thought, in the New York Times, that the voluntary leaks of the government on August 2nd about the conversation between the head of Al-Qaeda and the head of Yemen was actually did more harm to national security than all of the papers, you all saw that, released by Snowden, for example. But it's again an example of the cynical use of national security, that if the government does it, it's legitimate. And the fact is that most of the classified information, it shouldn't be classified, but it's routinely leaked, as was the story about the success of that electronic surveillance, because they wanted to show that what NSA does is necessary and so forth, which actually shut down the communication. You know, the government, if they leak, it's legitimate. If a whistleblower leaks something that's embarrassing, you know, for instance, we're spying on the leader of Brazil and on the leading company in Brazil or something, well, then that's, espionage. And which is what Snowden is accused of. And it seems to me the really ominous aspect here is the use of the national security argument to justify this vast expanse of the surveillance state. And I don't know if you want to comment on it or...
I think that with 9/11, as many of you know, the Patriot Act pretty much had been written before, was quickly pushed through by people who didn't read it. But I think because the United States felt perhaps that our country was impermeable, could not ever be attacked, it gave our leaders an opportunity really to exploit public fears and shock, I think to take advantage of a tragedy, but one that was a criminal act, one that did not warrant stigmatizing an entire group of people or country. And I think one of the things that ties into the whole safety issue, which I'm especially concerned about, is what we're seeing now, called American exceptionalism, that we as a country have a kind of pride and attitude that, especially with the spying on allied nations, we feel that we can do whatever we want, and when people that we, countries that we've worked with and who are considered our friends find out that we've been spying on them, I think that does a lot of damage in terms of our credibility. I also think, as you said, the Obama administration, quite frankly, is just embarrassed by these revelations. And yes, Obama has classified more documents, I believe, than any other administration, and yet gave information for the filmmakers of Zero Dark Thirty on the Osama bin Laden nighttime raid. They do want to control information. The attacks on members of the press and on a free press is especially troubling to democracy. We saw that in the 60s where in COINTELPRO, independent free newspapers were targeted. The government went and got records from banks of subscribers to newspapers, and as a result, those periodicals that reported on anti-war activities and other sort of less left-wing activities mostly went out of business. And the fact that the corporate media now really dictates what information we'll see I think all factors in, combined with Obama threatening reporters with charges of espionage or conspiracy and going after reporters, is another way that our personal liberties are gravely imperiled.
How do you explain it? I mean, he's brought, there were what, three cases of espionage brought before Obama? There have now been seven. Here's a constitutional law professor. I don't know, I voted for him twice.
Me too.
Stupidly panicked and donated more money than I could afford at one point. How do you explain this? How do you...
Corporations. He's beholden to them, as most of the last few presidents have been, to get into office. And I think that in many respects, one of the facts I find very interesting is that a high percentage of 3- and 4-star generals, when they retire, go to work in private security, then in turn often consult with the government. I think that's a conflict of interest, especially if they're lobbying to buy more drones or whatever the product is that they make. But there's a blurring of the lines between some of the functions we traditionally think of as governmental functions with attendant oversight that we expect from them, such as conducting intelligence. I think corporations need an intelligence apparatus to stay in business. The more information we can gather, the better it is for them. And with a trend in a conservative Supreme Court that is giving corporations the same rights, free speech rights, that people have, I think that all of those factors combine to really rob a lot of us of our ability to choose and to engage in the kind of activities that hold a government in check.
So you have, in one of the strengths of your book, we haven't talked about your book at all, but it has these great case studies and also a lot of documentation. Can you give some of those case studies?
I was going to suggest one.
Maybe you could talk about Occupy a little bit and how the power of the state was used against people.
In Freedom of Information Act requests that came out at least a year after Occupy kind of lost some of its steam, but not all, it came out that even before the first Occupy event, the Department of Homeland Security was going around the country and meeting with financial officials, bank representatives, local police departments, telling them that you better watch out. They're going to be occupiers. They may be attacking local banks, having protests. They met with the chambers of commerce, for example. What this shows is the enormous amount of coordination between federal law enforcement agencies and local businesses. And it's also worth noting that if you don't know what fusion centers are, they were created a few years after the attacks of 9/11, ostensibly to help streamline intelligence gathering and sharing across the country, because the 9/11 Commission report greatly criticized how that happens in this country. They partner with businesses, so it's not just law enforcement, but it's the private sector. And in at least one report, a pretty harsh report by the government, I think General Accounting Office, found that fusion centers were really pools of ineptitude, enormously wasteful in terms of money, and were
Maybe
not...
You should explain what fusion centers are.
A fusion center is a little, well, an entity, I think there are about 80 across the country, where different levels of law enforcement share information with, again, local businesses to a certain extent to try to improve some level of law enforcement intelligence gathering and sharing. One of the ways that they took recommendations from the 9/11 Commission to try to improve how we do intelligence in this country, to make us safer. But they've been ineffective, and I think there have been many examples of, you know, large surveillance networks, large computer databases that we've poured billions of dollars into that have been sloppily managed by the private sector and that have failed.
Yeah, well, it sort of brings up Dwight Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we didn't really have a sophisticated enemy anywhere. We tried to go with China, but China was funding us so amply we couldn't go too far. And then this gift that doesn't stop giving of terrorism happened. And it's sort of, you mentioned the 9/11 Commission, and it really goes to the question of what do we have the right to know and what is classification? And I've been intrigued by this 9/11 Commission. Here, okay, the whole enemy is this Al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attack. But now, as a lawyer and as a constitutional lawyer, we haven't had a trial of these people. We know very little about them. We have not had any kind of public. Who is Muhammad, you know, blah, blah, blah. Kali Sheikh Muhammad. Who are these people? What was driving them? So we have this enemy that we really don't care to know too much about. In the 9/11 Commission report, I used to remember the page, I don't now, but there's a disclaimer box in which these people on the commission who had the highest security, right, appointed by the president, say very clearly, we asked to see the key witnesses in Guantanamo. We were denied that right. We then wanted to put questions to him. We were denied that right. We were even denied the right to talk to the people who questioned them. So you have a whole narrative of what happened on 9/11 based on official leaks of information from the government to the 9/11 Commission. No vetting, no examination.
Now for something completely different.